This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they may live upon the earth. And certainly this program is important for all people because we are seeing the effects of my book, Jewish Supremacism, every day in the real world. We are seeing it with the incredible catastrophe that's happened to the Lebanese people, the murder, the destruction, the wanton hatred that was exercised against them in bombs and bullets and destruction. We have seen it in what's happened to the Palestinian people on the West Bank and in Gaza. And we've seen it what's happened to the American people. We've seen our sons be maimed and killed by the thousands in Iraq, in a war not for America, but for Israel. Yesterday, in my own way, I commemorated the events of 9/11, the terrible events that every American was touched by deeply and will continue to be touched by all their lives. We will all remember exactly where we were and what we were doing on September 11, 2001. The interesting thing to me is that we've gone now 5 years after this case, and still there's so many facts about the case that are hidden from the American people. One of the most important facts, I believe, in terms of this case is the fact that Israel, certainly, as all the evidence shows, knew in advance about this attack. We know there were advance warning to Israeli firms in the World Trade Center. We know that Israeli Mossad agents were caught filming and cheering and celebrating the attacks on a rooftop. We know for a fact that Israeli agents were shadowing the hijacked leader Mohammed Atta and at least half of the hijackers for many months. We know that an Israeli spy team had the capability of tapping almost any phone in the United States of America. And some of these things we know from independent sources, others we know from even news sources like Fox News Network that did a four-part series. There's also some other glaring aspects of 9/11 that I'll talk about for a moment before, again, I go into the latest part of Jewish Supremacism, the audio book that I'm offering for the people of the world free. And I'm in the middle of the Holocaust Inquiry chapter, a very important chapter. Whatever the truth is about different aspects of the Holocaust, we will not know that truth, or we can't know the truth, unless there is free inquiry, unless people have the ability to question certain aspects and challenge certain aspects of this historical, quote, truth. People are often called Holocaust deniers for simply questioning aspects of the Holocaust, and yet, over the years, there's been a number of revisions of the Holocaust story. Auschwitz used to have a plaque on the camp saying 4.2 million people were murdered there. Quietly, a few years ago, that plaque was taken down. Another plaque was put up saying 1.1 million. One of the leading researchers of Auschwitz, in fact, the authority who was commissioned by the Holocaust people themselves, now suggests the numbers are between 400,000 and 600,000. There's a lot of questions concerning the Holocaust, the nature of it. Was there a planned extermination of all the Jews of Europe, or were the deaths as a result of what happened during the war, the exigencies of the war, the starvation that took place, the disease epidemics that swept civilian areas and including things such as concentration camps? There's lots of questions about this entire issue. I take no hard position on it, but I do take a position that we must have freedom of speech and press upon it. Before I go into this chapter, I want to mention again something that I want to shout from the rooftops and continue to talk about for a long time until people begin to hear me. You know, can anyone tell me why it's not newsworthy to report that Michael Chertoff, the current head of America's Homeland Security, has close ties to a man named Magdu Elmer? And this is a man described by U.S. Representative Ben Gilman of New York, a member of the International Relations Committee, the House of Representatives, as, quote, having had close financial ties with bin Laden for years. And that was from the August 2nd, 2002 NBC Dateline program, if anybody thinks I'm making this up. How can it not be news that this extreme Zionist, Michael Chertoff, the man appointed as head of America's Homeland Security, has ties with a man who is suspected of financing 9/11? Chertoff, as U.S. Attorney in Newark, knew that Elmer was the chief contributor, financier of the mosque, the same mosque where the first WTC bombing attack in 1993 was planned. He had to know because he was U.S. Attorney there, and they're in charge of those kinds of investigations. It was in his district. In spite of that fact, Chertoff became Elmer's attorney, even though he had to know about Elmer's suspected connection with the bombing, and even after he knew that Elmer and his brother were at the center of a successful BATF terrorist sting operation. The terrorist sting operation was called Operation Diamondback, and Elmer and his brother were at the center of it, and that was a investigation dealing with buying terrorist weapons from Pakistan. Now, when Chertoff was appointed the head of the Justice Department Criminal Division and Terrorism Task Force, he quietly squashed a planned terrorism indictment of his client, former client, Magdu Elmer. Now, in spite of this amazing link of Chertoff's to 9/11, Chertoff became head of Homeland Security without nary a word, with nary a word in our controlled press of his ties to the suspected financier of the 9/11 attacks, Magdu Elmer. Now, if that's not news, that the head of Homeland Security has close ties to the man suspected of financing 9/11, pray tell me, somebody, what is. Now, this is the same man also, Michael Chertoff, who freed the huge Israeli spy ring captured in the wake of 9/11. On this day after the anniversary of 9/11, I think you might want to contemplate this amazing fact and also notice that necessarily everything you read in our controlled media is not necessarily newsworthy. And they leave out a lot of facts and a lot of important things that we should know. What a strange and crazy world we live in, ladies and gentlemen. A man who has close ties to the suspected financier of 9/11 has become our head of Homeland Security, and the American people don't even know this fascinating and amazing fact. Well, here we go. This is the next section of Jewish Supremacism, Chapter 12, A Holocaust Inquiry, and this section goes into the motives, are the proposed or suspected motives of the Holocaust story, of those who wrote and spread the Holocaust story around the world. Okay, here we go. Now we'll go into the section called Scientific Evidence. In a criminal trial, scientific evidence is usually the most powerful because it can be validated in an objective and scientific manner. There is no scientific evidence indicating mass gassings at Auschwitz or any other German camp, according to the revisionists. The United States Army had toxicology experts do autopsies on hundreds of dead in the Nazi concentration camps. Human remains can show signs of cyanide poisoning for many years. No scientific evidence existed or exists that even one of the victims were gassed to death. Nor do records of autopsies by German or Russian doctors in the Eastern European camps show any evidence of gassing. Although autopsies had been performed, the results were not presented at Nuremberg. Why? Is it because the results would not have served the prosecution, since none of the deaths could be blamed on poison gas? In every murder trial, does not the prosecution attempt to show the cause of death? In the most publicized murder trials of all time, the International Military Tribunal, proof of the cause of death is conspicuously absent. If the Nazis had really gassed people by the millions, would not the prosecution produce at least one autopsy proving the cause of death to be poisoning by the cyanide gas produced by Zyklon B? Holocaust orthodoxy experts claim that one proof of the gassing of human beings is the great quantity of Zyklon B used at Auschwitz during the war. Attempting to rebut revisionist questions of gas chambers, Jean-Claude Pressac, a French chemist, in his book Auschwitz, Techniques and Operation of the Gas Chambers, supplies data showing the large consumption of Zyklon B at Auschwitz. A more logical explanation could be that simply the Germans had used the chemical in an effort to control the epidemics that ravaged the camps. Additionally, the data published by Pressac himself shows the per capita amount of Zyklon B used in the Auschwitz concentration camp was similar to Zyklon B consumption in German camps such as Oranienburg, where the experts admit that no human gassing took place. If Auschwitz was the great center of extermination, and if Zyklon B was the poison used, how could it be that records of the chemical's purchase and usage show no greater consumption at Auschwitz than at the many concentration camps where Zyklon B was used strictly for lice infestation and where there were no alleged gassings? Pressac also inadvertently revealed that coke consumption was no greater per capita in Auschwitz than the camps in Germany where extermination is not alleged. Literally mountains of coke would have been necessary to cremate the alleged number of Auschwitz victims. In February 1988, the Canadian government charged Holocaust questioner Ernst Zundel with violating an archaic law against, quote, spreading false news, unquote. Defense attorneys in his criminal case commissioned an American engineering consultant on prison gas chambers, Fred Leuchter, to make a scientific examination of the alleged homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz. Leuchter, an apolitical person, is perhaps the premier authority in the United States on the construction and use of execution equipment, and he was actually in charge in design and construction of execution facilities used in a number of American prisons. In his investigation, Leuchter surveyed the construction of the alleged gas chambers and researched the chemical properties of the Zyklon B fumigant. He found that Zyklon B is a compound that, when exposed to air, releases deadly hydrogen cyanide gas that clings to surfaces and has a tendency to react chemically with materials containing iron, ferric compounds, creating a ferrocyanide. If Zyklon B is used in iron chambers or in red brick structures, it reacts with ferrous iron material to produce a distinctive blue color. The printing ink industry has used these chemical reactions for many decades to produce a distinctive color called Prussian blue. Random House Webster Electronic Dictionary 1992 edition defines it as follows: Prussian blue, noun, a moderate to deep greenish blue, a dark blue crystalline water-insoluble ferrocyanide pigment used in painting, fabric, printing, and laundry bluing. Not only did Leuchter find that the supposed homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz were structurally unsuitable for gassing, he also took samples from the walls and had them chemically analyzed. Independent laboratories in the United States found no evidence of the ferrocyanide compounds. Yet when Leuchter examined the rooms used as disinfection chambers for clothes and luggage, he readily observed the distinctive blue coloring associated with ferrocyanide. After further chemical analysis of the samples, he proved that the disinfection walls had heavy concentrations of the ferrocyanide caused by exposure to cyanide. Leuchter also pointed out that the disinfection chambers used for delousing clothes were well made, airtight, and designed for safety. On the other hand, the supposed human gas chambers were shoddily constructed. He asked why gas chambers for killing lice would be properly engineered, whereas chambers alleged for killing millions of people would be improperly engineered and constructed and dangerous for its operators. The next section is the fight against revisionism. When Leuchter published his report, Holocaust authorities reacted predictably, with defamation, suppression, intimidation, and even imprisonment. Leuchter became the victim of an intense international campaign to discredit him and ruin him financially. Jewish groups wrote defamatory letters to all of his state penitentiary clients, urging them to cancel his contracts. They were able to get authorities to prosecute him in his home state of Massachusetts in spite of his obvious expertise and his patents under an Arkine statute of practicing engineering without a license. The German government jailed Leuchter for 6 weeks simply for reporting his technical findings in a lecture in November 1991 at Weisheim. For simply translating and commenting on Leuchter's speech, Mr. Gunther Deckert, a former high school teacher with a clean record, was sentenced to a year's probation. In their verdict, the judges, Dr. Orlett and Dr. Mueller, pointed out that Deckert was a city councilor who graduated with distinction in law from Heidelberg University and was of high moral character. Because they did not sentence Deckert harshly enough, according to the international press, the judges themselves faced intimidation and efforts to overturn the sentence they imposed. Frau Selene Leutheusser Schnarrenberger, the German Minister of Justice, called the verdict a slap in the face for every victim of the Holocaust and had two judges suspended. The two judges suspended and placed on sick leave. Mannheim prosecutor Hans Klein appealed the verdict with the result that Mr. Deckert received a 2-year jail sentence. Klein also promised to go over the wording of the verdict in search of anything that might be grounds for prosecuting the two judges. It is obviously not a free system if a judge can face termination or even be criminally charged for stating why he is lenient within the bounds of his authority. You know, it seems little has changed in Germany during this century. In America, it's hard to imagine someone going to jail simply for translating a scientific lecture, or having judges suspended or threatened with arrest for rendering a verdict or sentence deemed politically incorrect. Nevertheless, there are methods of protecting, and there are needs of protecting the Holocaust story. Germany is not the only other violator of free speech in this matter. Sometime later, the frail and spectacled Fred Leuchter was also incarcerated and forcibly deported from Great Britain. A year after Leuchter had his controversy, the Auschwitz Museum staffers secretly duplicated Leuchter's tests and arrived at the same scientific results. They do not, however, discuss these scientific facts in their guidebooks. Their feeble explanation for the lack of ferrocyanide in the human gas chambers is that somehow it dissipated over time, and that is a chemical impossibility. They offer no explanation why the ferrocyanide did not dissipate in the disinfection chambers. Another Holocaust expert argued that it takes less cyanide to kill humans than it does to kill lice. Therefore, there would be less in the human gas chambers than in disinfection chambers. Yet, it is alleged that huge amounts of Zyklon B were used to kill millions of people in veritable, quote, factories of death. The Holocaust revisionists, in spite of enduring vicious attacks from the press, caused a stir by the release of the Leuchter report and subsequent revelation of the details of Auschwitz's own chemical study that the Auschwitz staff authorized, then a new investigation that purports to refute Leuchter and their own earlier study. However, they will still not allow any independent studies by scientists and engineers, although it would be relatively easy and quick to obtain samples and do analysis of the alleged gas chamber walls. Repeatedly, in the study of the Holocaust, those with a personal and political stake at maintaining their version of events are opposed to academic or scientific inquiry. They endeavor to prevent a physical inspection of records or scientific studies of the sites, and they make even the public reporting of scientific or historical investigations punishable by imprisonment. Even a well-respected Jewish historian who believes in the existence of the gas chambers offers a somewhat revisionist viewpoint. In his 1988 book, Why Did the Heavens Not Darken? The Final Solution in History, Princeton University professor Arno J. Mayer pointed out that there are many questions about the Holocaust. Mayer himself lost close family in the Holocaust, and he writes, quote, Many questions remain open. All in all, how many bodies were cremated at Auschwitz? How many died there, all told? What was the national, religious, and ethnic breakdown of this commonwealth of victims? How many of them were condemned to die a natural death, and how many were deliberately slaughtered? We simply have no answers to these questions at this time. And also, from 1942 to 1945, certainly at Auschwitz, but probably overall, more Jews were killed by so-called natural causes than by unnatural ones. It's from page 365 of his book. And sources for the study of the gas chambers are at once rare and unreliable. I must repeat that Meyer strongly believes that gas chambers did exist at Auschwitz, but he points out that most of what is known is based on the depositions of Nazi officials and executioners at post-war trials and on the memory of survivors and bystanders. This testimony must be screened carefully, since it can be influenced by subjective factors of great complexity, unquote. Meyer's statements would be grounds for prosecution, by the way, in France and Germany. And again, I must state, I am not stating categorically that there were no gas chambers at Auschwitz, but I'm trying to point out that these are some of the questions that some of the questioners have about this period. And if we cannot allow questions, then we don't allow freedom. And if we cannot allow questioning, then we certainly cannot be sure of the ultimate truth on any issue, whether you talk about religion, or whether you talk about historical events, or whether you talk about scientific evidence. This is the basis of free speech and the basis of understanding. The next section is called Witnesses to the Holocaust. As Meyer points out, much of the Holocaust story is based on eyewitness accounts. Revisionists argue that so-called eyewitness testimony is not always reliable. They give us an example, the John Demjanjuk case. Demjanjuk, a naturalized American auto worker from Eastern Europe, was accused of being Ivan the Terrible, a nefarious concentration camp guard at Treblinka concentration camp, who allegedly murdered hundreds of people. Demjanjuk maintained his innocence, but hundreds of Jewish eyewitnesses testified that he was Ivan. The witnesses screamed, cried, and postured, telling the most incredible stories of cruelty and sadism. They swore under oath that they clearly remembered that Demjanjuk was Ivan. Ultimately, Demjanjuk was deported to Israel, and an Israeli court tried and convicted him, primarily on eyewitness testimony. But new evidence came forward that proved that the Soviet KGB had framed Demjanjuk. Documents that supposedly showed him to be a guard proved to be Soviet forgeries. When faced with a worldwide scandal, even the Israeli Supreme Court had to agree that the eyewitness accounts were not credible and that Demjanjuk was innocent. The next section is entitled Those Crazy Numbers. In examining the Holocaust, I found that sources varied wildly in their estimations of the numbers killed, ranging from 4 to 24 million. Reproduced below is the entry under Holocaust in the Compton's Multimedia Encyclopedia, 1991. As Nazi Germany gained control of one country after another in World War II, there was much killing of civilians and maltreatment of soldiers that can be classified as war crimes. These crimes, however, pale in comparison to the massive, deliberate, and well-planned extermination of more than 15 million persons in what is termed the Holocaust. This genocide of staggering proportions was carried out with scrupulous efficiency by a well-coordinated German bureaucracy in which nothing was left to chance. Unquote. Now, elsewhere in the same Compton's Encyclopedia, under the topic of concentration camp, is the following statement. Quote, "The most horrible extension of the concentration camp system was the establishment of extermination centers after 1940. They were set up primarily to kill Jews. This slaughter is known as the Holocaust. It's believed that from 18 to 26 million people were killed in them, including 6 million Jews and 400,000 gypsies." Holocaust chroniclers assessing German crimes obviously see no need for accuracy or even consistency. But regardless of which set of figures are used, the figures are so fantastic that they strain credulity. If 18 to 26 million people were murdered and cremated in the extermination centers of Poland, most of them Auschwitz, which is basically the Holocaust theory, the daily count would have had to have been in the tens of thousands of people. As cited previously, the expert most cited by the Holocaust scholars themselves, Pressick, now estimates the death toll at Auschwitz of all victims from all causes seems to have been between 600 and 800,000. Now, how do these figures, which themselves could be greatly exaggerated, square with the wild numbers for Auschwitz bandied about in the popular encyclopedias? When a man is accused of such terrible crimes, shouldn't there be at least a demand for accuracy and consistency? If not, then any person could be accused of any transgression without fear of reproach. Dr. Norman Finkelstein, a Jewish scholar whose own parents suffered in the German concentration camps, has caused a furor for writing The Holocaust Industry. In this groundbreaking book, he proves the blatant fabrication of many of the Holocaust advocates. He shows that their own numbers make the Holocaust, as they portray it, impossible. Here's a direct quote. In an authoritative study, Leonard Dinnerstein reported 60,000 Jews walked out of the concentration camps. Within a week, more than 20,000 of them had died. But as it entered into negotiations with Germany just 2 years ago in 1999, the Holocaust industry demanded compensation for 135,000 still living former camp inmates. If 135,000 former Jewish slave laborers are still alive today, some 600,000 must have survived the war. That's at least 500,000 more than standard estimates. If Jews only constituted 20% of the surviving camp population, as the Holocaust industry implies 600,000 Jewish inmates survived the war, then fully 3 million inmates in total must have survived. By the Holocaust industry's reckoning, concentration camp conditions couldn't have been that harsh at all. In fact, one might suppose a remarkably high fertility and remarkably low mortality rate. If, as the Holocaust industry suggests, many hundreds of thousands of Jews survived, the final solution couldn't have been all that efficient after all. Exactly what the Holocaust deniers argue. Unquote. About the time I noticed the discrepancies in Holocaust numbers, I saw a television interview of a Zionist who attacked Holocaust revisionism by saying that, quote, whether it was 10 million or 1 million, 100,000 or 1,000, it does not make the crime any less abhorrent. The truth is that if hundreds of thousands rather than up to 26 million died, and if most of those deaths were caused by the expected brutalities of war rather than the calculated plan of extermination, then the prevalent version of the Holocaust story is grossly inaccurate. The next section, entitled Other Holocaust Questions. The main component of the Holocaust story is that the Nazis had a plan or program for exterminating the Jews. But even though the Allies captured Germany's government and military headquarters and most of the concentration camps with their records intact, there has never been a single order or instruction found that calls explicitly for the gassing of Jews or that indicates a plan to exterminate all of European Jewry. No blueprint has been found for the construction of a human gas chamber, or clear instructions or orders written for gassing human beings. On this subject, as on others, the Holocaust story has undergone dramatic revision. No longer do the experts claim the Nazis gave direct orders to exterminate the Jews. Paul Raul Hilberg, in his 1961 first edition of his major work on the Holocaust, The Destruction of European Jewry, wrote that in 1941 Hitler had issued two orders for the extermination of the Jews. in Hilberg's revised three-volume edition of the book published in 1985. All reference to such orders have been removed. In a review of Hilberg's revised edition, historian Christopher Browning himself, an exterminationist historian, wrote, quote, "In the new edition, all references in the text to a Hitler decision or a Hitler order for the final solution have been systematically excised. Buried at the bottom of a single footnote stands the solitary reference. Chronology and circumstances point to a Hitler decision before the summer ended. In the new edition, decisions were not made and orders were not given." Unquote. The next section is called "A Holocaust Under the Nose of the Red Cross." Jewish leaders have directed anger toward the International Red Cross for not revealing the Holocaust or doing anything to stop it. They point out that international teams of Red Cross inspectors visited and inspected every major German concentration camp, including Auschwitz, right up to the end of the war. On the one hand, the Holocausters expect us to believe that the Germans were murdering tens of thousands of people a day in a super-secret plan that they dared not mention, even in their top-secret orders. And on the other, they expect us to believe that the Nazis would let the International Red Cross, with people from many different countries, inspect those same camps and interview the prisoners freely during the same period that they were supposedly killing many thousands each day in those same camps. Here's excerpts from a telling USA Today article, and I quote, "Many Jewish leaders and Holocaust experts have long contended that the Red Cross failed spectacularly during World War II, mostly by not raising an alarm about Nazi atrocities, and compounded the failure by refusing to acknowledge it. In fact, in a November 22, 1944 letter to the U.S. State Department officials about the visit, the Red Cross said, quote, we had not been able to discover any trace of installations for exterminating civilian prisoners. In this case, the documents show the Red Cross failed at every possible turn. Not only had the Red Cross officials neglected to grasp the situation, but then they passed along bad information to the Allies. A tendency to disbelieve horror stories. Several Red Cross documents suggest that the organization was reluctant, at least initially, to put much faith in tales and rumors of Nazi brutality. Like the general public, Red Cross officials didn't comprehend the true extent of the Nazis' crimes. There is no doubt that the Red Cross let itself be used by the Nazis, says Radu Ayanid, director of the Holocaust Survivors Registry at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. There is no doubt they were fooled. Unquote. Obviously, if the grievously high death toll was from lack of medicine, shortage of insecticide for killing of disease-spreading lice, and food, because of the destruction and disruption of the war, the Nazis would have had no fear of international Red Cross inspectors and volunteers in the camps helping out with the situation any more than the British would have feared them helping in the ruins of East London after an air raid. Do the promoters of the Holocaust story believe that the members of the International Red Cross were part of an anti-Semitic Nazi Holocaust conspiracy? Or did their members from many different countries, in spite of visiting the camps during the war repeatedly and delivering to prisoners 973,000 packages and parcels, as our own records show, did they simply see no evidence at all of mass gassings or burnings or extermination facilities, or for that matter, any effort on the part of the Nazis to purposefully exterminate the Jewish people? While helping hundreds of thousands of refugees, Red Cross volunteers undoubtedly heard stories of Nazi brutality and rumors of mass gassings, and they noted those rumors, and they kept an eye out for any evidence of them. But they saw nothing to indicate that the rumors were true. At the end of the war, in camps such as Buchenwald, they saw great numbers of bodies, but their own reports laid the horror on disease epidemics, which even the British occupiers and the Red Cross itself had incredible difficulty controlling. For instance, the British estimated that more people perished after they assumed control of the Bergen-Belsen facility, then before the camp's liberation. Jewish forces condemn revisionists who raise common sense questions about the Holocaust, such as how could there have been a huge Holocaust going on right under the nose of the International Red Cross? Or why on earth would the Germans allow Red Cross inspections of the camps if they were actually death camps that were exterminating tens of thousands of people? It is no wonder that the Holocaust promoters want such questions quashed and the questioners imprisoned. Their version of the Holocaust story, and some aspects of it, cannot withstand much critical inquiry. The best way to determine the truth or validity about these revisionist claims, as I'm showing in this chapter, is by a full and honest debate on these subjects, and the ability for historians to freely research and freely come up with their own conclusions and print, publish, and speak them without fear of societal emulation or imprisonment. The next section is why no debate. The official keepers of the Holocaust wage an international campaign to silence the disturbing questions. Most people never even hear the revisionist position because Jewish forces so dominate the media and block mainstream access to material that questions Holocaust orthodoxy. Among the most potent of such forces is the worldwide Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which has a $37 million annual budget in the United States devoted to defaming those who criticize Israel or question parts of the Holocaust tale. The ADL instructs its spokesman never to debate any aspect of the Holocaust. If their version of the Holocaust is so overwhelmingly documented, why do they fear such free and open discussion or debate? An honest debate between the high priests of the Holocaust and Holocaust questioners would reveal that the latter are not crackpots or hate mongers, but people with legitimate questions and arguments based on what they see as sound evidence. Such a debate would reveal that revisionists do not deny that Jews, like the Japanese in World War II America, were incarcerated in concentration camps. Revisionists acknowledge that the conditions in the European camps were horrendous near war's end, and they maintain that many thousands of Jews died in the camps, mostly from malnutrition and disease. Finally, revisionists also freely admit that some massacres of innocent civilians took place and that such horrors must be condemned. Revisionists maintain that while there were certainly Germans who committed what is today defined as war crimes, that the Allies themselves, which include the Soviets, were guilty of them to at least an equal degree. Revisionists point out to the Allied intentional firebombing of civilian populations, as well as to the Soviets' mass rape, expulsion, and murder of millions of Germans and other peoples of Eastern Europe. They also point out that many of the deaths in the concentration camps in the last years of the war were caused by Allied bombing of rail lines vital for transportation of food and medicines. They point out that specific targeting and destruction of pharmaceutical factories that produced medicines and medical supplies increased the death rate among German civilians and soldiers, as well as increasing the deaths in the camps. To challenge the popular perception of the Holocaust, obviously, is not condoning mass murder. Those who refute the popular conception of the Holocaust make it clear that they view atrocities against innocent Jews or other people as crimes against the moral values of Western civilization. Revisionists simply contend that the Jews were not the only victims of the world's most horrific war. Many revisionists also argue that the motive for the horrendous Holocaust story is the furtherance of the economic and political objectives of Israel and the Jewish organizations around the world. When I began to learn many of the disturbing facts that challenged my perceptions of the Holocaust, I asked myself how the Holocaust story began and why it is so ubiquitous more than 50 years after the end of the Second World War. Usually there's a great deal of bitterness and hatred at the end of any war, but as time passes, hysteria lessens and cooler heads prevail. Yet there seems to be as much, if not more, frenzy about German war crimes today than there was immediately after the war. Just months after the war's end, the U.S. Senate leader Robert Taft condemned the International Military Tribunal as a blot on the American record we will long regret. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Harlan Fiske Stone, said of Justice Jackson, who left the court to head the tribunal, quote, "Jackson is away conducting his high-grade lynching party in Nuremberg. I don't mind what he does to the Nazis. But I hate to see the pretense that he is running a court proceeding according to the common law. This is a little too sanctimonious a fraud to meet my old-fashioned ideas." 50 years later, one would be hard-pressed to find even one American congressman who would dare condemn the war crimes trials, even if he secretly harbored that opinion. He would know that uttering it would bring upon his head such wrath that his political career would be over. What is the motive, then, that keeps Holocausters striving to keep the story so ingrained in our minds and hearts? Well, ladies and gentlemen, what an interesting chapter this is, isn't it? We're going to continue with this chapter in tomorrow's broadcast, the final part of the chapter. I think you're going to find that part very, very interesting and riveting. I think the Holocaust is certainly one of the biggest covered issues of the day. I think it's and not any small part due to the fact that we have a tremendous weight of Jewish influence in our media, and their concerns become our concerns, obviously. And the Holocaust, whatever you think of the different aspects of the Holocaust, it's certainly become an incredible weapon for Israel in marshaling the world support and in making the world turn a blind eye to the terrible treatment of the Palestinian people and what they've done, for instance, recently in Lebanon. I hope all of you will take the opportunity to archive this live broadcast and make sure that your friends and family know about it. And also, please help them spread the word of my website and my work. Take these articles. There's many of them that are nice, short articles. Cut and paste them. Go to forums around the world and put them in, especially with some good links to my site. And let's spread the word. The ideas and the information on my site are obviously very powerful, and the citations, the sources are incredible, and they are impeccable. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Until that time, thanks so much for your listening, and thanks so much for your dedication for truth and freedom and for decency toward all people. As I have to repeat and repeat, because the media never stops the refrain against me, I am not a supremacist in any way. I don't believe in human hate. I certainly am opposed to any and all forms of violence and terrorism. And in fact, because I take these positions, I am opposed to Jewish supremacism. I certainly recognize the right of the Jewish people to preserve their heritage, their way of life, you know, their values, their songs, their very genotype. They have that right. But also, ladies and gentlemen, we have that right. And I don't think they have the right, or that we must lay down and let them control or be supreme, exercise their supremacy over our media or over our government policy. We're paying a price for that in Iraq every day, and paying a price in an incalculable number of ways. Thanks for being with me. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Until then, God bless and take care.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddude.com.